We're going to be looking at John chapter 2 today. While you're turning there, if you are wanting to turn there, you don't have to. Many years ago, my wife and I went for a late night visit to Arby's. We felt like having a beef and cheddar. So we got to Arby's and we ordered two beef and cheddars, only to have the rather embarrassed looking person behind the counter say rather sheepishly, we're all out of roast beef. I said, when will the next batch be ready? She said, no, we're out. We have none. I said, excuse me, Arby's has no roast beef. She said, don't make it worse. Yeah, I have also heard of Swiss Chalet running out of chicken before. And, you know, these things happen. You can't run a business for, you know, day after week after month after year and not expect that at some point there's going to be a problem with the supply chain somewhere and you're going to have to eat a huge slice of humble pie and explain to your patrons that you don't have the thing that made your restaurant great today. But come back tomorrow and you'll probably have it. Now, imagine being at a wedding reception where they didn't have enough food to go around. We're not talking about a business that has to have it every day. We're talking about a one-time event, you know? Imagine how embarrassing that would be. Imagine how that would look on the person who was supposed to take care of the food. You know, you had one job. That would just be an incredibly embarrassing situation. The poor bride and groom for the rest of their lives are going to remember the humiliation of the reception on that day that was supposed to be the best day of their lives. Okay, now, walk all that back 2,000 years to a shame and honor culture, and that's where we find ourselves in John chapter 2. Okay, let's just go ahead and read that passage. John 2, I'm going to read the first 11 verses. On the third day, a wedding took place at Cana in Galilee. Jesus' mother was there, and Jesus and his disciples had also been invited to the wedding. When the wine was gone, Jesus' mother said to him, "They have no more wine." "Woman, why do you involve me?" Jesus replied. "My hour has not yet come." His mother said to the servants, "Do whatever he tells you." Nearby stood six stone water jars, the kind used by the Jews for ceremonial washing, each holding from 20 to 30 gallons. Jesus said to the servants, "Fill the jars with water." So they filled them to the brim. Then he told them, "Now draw some out and take it to the master of the banquet." They did so, and the master of the banquet tasted the water that had been turned into wine. He did not realize where it had come from, though the servants who had drawn the water knew. Then he called the bridegroom aside and he said, "Everyone brings out the choice wine first, and then the cheaper wine after the guests have had too much to drink. But you have saved the best till now." What Jesus did here in Cana of Galilee was the first of the signs through which he revealed his glory, and his disciples believed in him. This is really early on in Jesus' ministry. Evidently, it's 3 days after the calling of some of his very first disciples. So this is, again, really, really early in Jesus' ministry. Jesus and the disciples that he's called and Jesus' mom, Mary, all at this wedding reception together. And Mary finds out that they've run out of wine and goes to Jesus with the problem. Now, I can't imagine how difficult it would be to figure out how much wine or food to have at an event like this, because weddings in first century Palestine were events that went on like 5 to 7 days. How in the world are you supposed to know how much to plan for? but somehow or another, evidently they must have, but this guy got it wrong. So Mary finds out that they've run out of wine, and she goes to Jesus. Why? I'm not really sure, but certainly probably no one knows Jesus better than Mary at this point in his life. And there must have been something about Jesus that made her believe that he was capable of looking after this situation. Jesus' response to 21st century English people would seem very abrupt. Woman, why do you involve me? But if we go back to Jesus' culture, and probably the language has something to do with it as well, woman was not the same address that if I were to say to any of the sisters here, woman, what are you doing after, you know, that's not a term of respect. But in that language, in that culture, it was. Actually, we hear Jesus use that same terminology as he's hanging on the cross. Woman, behold your son. Son, behold your mother. So, if you've ever felt like Jesus was abrupt there, put that concern to rest. Jesus was speaking in tender respect to his mother. And then he says to her, why do you involve me? My hour has not yet come. Again, something a little bit confusing, because his hour hadn't come to that point, but from here on we see Jesus' ministry ramping up. But regardless of the confusing response that Jesus makes to his mother, she ignores it all and just says to the servants, do whatever he tells you to do. Was ever a better command or suggestion made in the history of the world? Do whatever Jesus tells you. Let's think about that as we go through the time that we have left this morning. Whatever he says to you, do it. There are three lessons that I would like for us to take away from this first miracle of Jesus. The first one we've already seen, the importance of absolute faith in the power of Jesus, like Mary is showing here. Whatever he says to you, do it. The second is the importance of complete obedience, no matter how unusual, no matter how sacrificial. Whatever he says to you, do it. Complete obedience, like these servants and we'll get to that in a minute. And the third lesson is God's ability to take the weak, feeble, frail human efforts by which we try to serve him and turn it into something great. Let's look at a few examples in the Bible where people demonstrated absolute faith in God's power. Joshua and Caleb. Joshua and Caleb were 2 out of 12 spies that were sent into the land of Canaan after the Israelites were released from slavery in Egypt. They're in the wilderness, and Moses says, let's send 12 spies into the promised land to spy it out and figure out the best way to take the land. Well, the land was amazing, and the 12 spies come back and say the land is amazing. But 10 of the 12 tribes say the land is so amazing and so are the people in the land that there's no way we can take them. the people look huge. We were like grasshoppers in their sight, and we were certainly like grasshoppers in our own sight. And only Joshua and Caleb stood up and said, "The land that we passed through and explored is exceedingly good. If the Lord is pleased with us, he will lead us into that land, a land flowing with milk and honey, and will give it to us. Only do not rebel against the Lord, and do not be afraid of the people of the land, because we will devour them. Their protection is gone, but the Lord is with us. Do not be afraid of them." Joshua and Caleb not only had absolute belief in the power of God, but they were standing up for him in the midst of a people who were not willing to believe. They were the ones who stood up and said, "Don't be like this. Yes, it's a challenge, but it's not a challenge that concerns our God. Our God is greater than any army. Our God created this whole universe. Conquering an army is nothing." Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. Nebuchadnezzar had built an idol 19 feet high. Everyone must come and worship this idol when they hear the music start. Well, once the music starts and the people have worshiped the idol and everyone's gone back home, spies go to Nebuchadnezzar and say, "You know, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, you just put them in very responsible positions in your government. They didn't do what you ordered." Nebuchadnezzar calls them in. "Hey, guys, let's review the law here. When you hear the music, you bow down to the idol. Now, next time, make sure you do it." And Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego says, "You know what? There's no need for a next time, because we're not going to do it then either." Daniel 3:17, "The God that we serve is able to deliver us." Oh, I forgot one little piece of information. If you don't bow down the next time as well, I'm going to throw you into a burning fiery furnace and incinerate you. And they still said, "There's no need. We don't have to go through this whole rigmarole again. Nothing's going to be different. The God that we serve is able to deliver us, and he will deliver us from your majesty's hand." Absolute faith in the power of God. He is capable of delivering us, and he will deliver us. Martha. Lazarus had two sisters, Mary and Martha. Martha sometimes gets a bad rap because she was the one who fussed about Mary not helping her with serving on a previous visit of Jesus. This time, Jesus has come to visit in response to hearing that their brother Lazarus has died. And who's the first person who comes to meet him at the gates of the city before he ever gets to the house? Martha comes running, and she says, "If you had been here, my brother would not have died. But I know that even now, God will give you whatever you ask." We talked in Bible class this morning about Abraham, who was called to sacrifice Isaac on the altar. And the Hebrew writer, in reflecting on that story, says Abraham believed that God was able to bring Isaac back from the dead, and so, in a manner of speaking, did receive Isaac back from the dead. And I don't think I'd ever thought about this before Bible class this morning, but as we were going through this, I realized there are no biblical accounts of God raising anyone from the dead at the time of Abraham or before. So Abraham not only believed that God could raise Isaac from the dead, he believed that despite any evidence that God was capable of raising the dead. Absolute faith in the power of God. The Hebrew writer says in Hebrews 11:1, "Faith is being confident of what we hope for, being sure of what we do not see." And then verse 6 of Hebrews 11, without faith, it is impossible to please God, because whoever would come to God must believe that he exists and that he rewards those who diligently seek him. Absolute faith in the power of God. The second thing we see in this story of water into wine is an unwavering commitment to do whatever Jesus asks, no matter how bizarre, no matter how sacrificial. Nearby stood 6 stone water jars. Jesus said to the servants, "Fill the jars with water." Not an unusual request, so they fill them with water. Then he told them, "Now draw some out and take it to the master of the banquet." Jesus, you know it's wine that they ran out of, right? Not water. But whatever was running through their minds stayed within their minds and did not come out in any sort of hesitation. They just followed Mary's advice and did whatever Jesus told them to do. Filled the jars with water, take some of it back out and serve it to the MC. Well, by the time the MC tasted that wine, he's like, "Come here," to the groom. "Let's come off to the side. I have something I want to tell you. What we've done here, what I'm seeing, is not proper first century Palestinian wine serving protocol. First, you serve the best while people still have all their faculties and can figure out that it's good wine. Once they've had a little too much to drink, they're not going to care as much about the caliber of the wine. That's when you bring out the cheap stuff. But you've saved the best till now." And isn't that just like Jesus? To go above and beyond, not only in quality, but in quantity. 120, 150, whatever gallons of good, top-of-the-line wine. All because the servants had complete obedience to God. Noah, a complete obeyer of God. Again, we talked about him this morning. Build an ark. What? Something that's going to float? Big enough to carry 2 of each kind of animal on earth. Float on what? I don't have seaside property here. No matter how bizarre. Gideon. God says, "Gideon, I want you to send home 99% of your army." Okay, then what? "Well, send the 1% into battle." Okay, and weapons? Oh, that's easy. Trumpets, pitchers, and lanterns. Okay. No matter how bizarre, Gideon sent the army into battle, or led the army into battle like that, and won. Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. We already talked about them. We talked about their complete faith in God. Our God is able to deliver us, and he will deliver us. But the next verse says, "But even if he does not, we want you to know, your majesty, that we will not serve your gods or worship the image of gold that you have set up." Complete obedience, no matter how bizarre, this time no matter how sacrificial. These men were putting their lives on the line. You go ahead and throw us into that fiery furnace if you want to, but it's not going to change our minds. We will not serve or bow down to the image that you have set up. Martha and the people of Bethany. Jesus says, roll the stone away. Jesus? You know he's been dead for 4 days already, right? You know what that means the moment that stone gets rolled away? It's going to smell. And yet, they went ahead and obeyed Jesus, no matter how bizarre the request. Because Jesus said, didn't I tell you that you would see the power of God? There are so many other examples. Thank goodness that we haven't been called to be Old Testament prophets. Isaiah, go stripped and barefoot for 3 years. Bizarre. Ezekiel, lie on your left side for 390 days, then on your right side for 40 days. Bizarre. Hosea, marry a prostitute. Bizarre. And then let's look at the words of Paul. Philippians chapter 3, verse 8. What is more, I consider everything a loss because of the surpassing worth of knowing Christ Jesus, my Lord, for whose sake I have lost all things. That's sacrificial. And Paul wasn't done losing all things at the time that he wrote that. He would go on to lose his life because he was willing to be faithful to his God. The Hebrew writer in chapter 11 goes through all those men of and women of faith, and then he just clumps a bunch into a couple of verses that I think are really beautiful. Hebrews 11, starting at verse 36, some faced jeers and flogging, and even chains and imprisonment. They were put to death by stoning. They were sawed in two. They were killed by the sword. They went about in sheepskins and goatskins, destitute, persecuted, mistreated. The world was not worthy of them. They wandered in deserts and mountains, living in caves and in holes in the ground. All because Jesus said, if you love me, you will keep my commandments. Well, those Old Testament people hadn't heard that New Testament sentence, but the sentiments are there all the way through Scripture. Follow God at all costs. Whatever he asks you to do, do it. Do it completely. Do it willingly. Jesus modeled that absolute faith in the power of God and coupled it with that unwavering commitment to do his will. And God coupled all of that together and crafted salvation for you and me. Beyond the absolute faith, the absolute obedience, is the unending trust that Jesus can take our limited efforts and use them to his glory. Sometimes we feel like we can do so little. We're only human. We're only one person, each of us. What difference can we make? What can we do? Well, once people of faith have obediently filled 6 cleansing vessels with water and hesitatingly served some out to the MC, Jesus was then in a position to show how much their feeble efforts mattered, as he did the rest, turning the water into wine. Our scripture reading this morning, the Philistines had conquered Israel. They had taken away all their weapons. And Jonathan one day says to his armor bearer, let's go see if God's going to give them to our hands. One man and a willing armor bearer who says, I'm with you heart and soul. Let's do whatever God has put on your mind to do. And you heard the story as Ellis read it to us. One man made such a difference that the entire Philistine army was defeated. Why? Because Jonathan and his armor bearer killed hundreds or thousands of people? No. They killed, what did it say, 20, I think? But God did the rest. Once somebody was willing to stand up and do something, God took over. Big earthquake, big confusion, Philistines turning on one another, turncoats from Israel coming back to Israel and fighting against them. Israelites who haven't been willing to fight, hearing that the Philistines are fleeing, and then get emboldened to join in the fight and pursue them. But it started with one man and one armor bearer and a willingness to be used by God. And God did the rest. The feeding of the 5,000. Jesus said, so what do we got in the way of food, guys? And Andrew said, well, there's a little boy here with 5 loaves and 2 fish, but what is that among so many? Isn't that how we tend to feel? I'm one person. What am I among so many? But Jesus said, bring the fish and the loaves to me. And he got everyone to sit down on the grass, and he blessed the loaves and broke them and distributed it to everyone. And once all of the 5,000 people had eaten, Jesus said, gather up whatever fragments remain, let nothing be wasted. And they gather up 12 baskets of fragments. Now, unless my math is wrong, you don't need 12 baskets to gather up 5 loaves and 2 fish. That needs 7 baskets max. Something amazing happened there because of a ridiculously small investment of 5 loaves and 2 fish. But Jesus did the rest. The widow's mite. Luke 21, verse 2. He also saw a poor widow put in 2 very small copper coins. Truly I tell you, Jesus said, this poor widow has put in more than all the others. All these people gave their gifts out of their wealth, but she, out of her poverty, put in all she had to live on. A friend of mine one time said, the first question I have when I get to heaven is I want to ask that widow what she had for supper that night. Because you can believe that Jesus provided her supper. She put in all that she had to live on. Because God sees more than the 2 mites. God sees the incredible sacrificial giving done by a heart of faith. Absolute faith in the power of God. Unwavering commitment to complete obedience. And God's ability to transform our feeble human efforts into great things. Absolute faith. Blind men come to Jesus for healing. Jesus says, do you believe I can do this? And they say, yes. And Jesus says, listen to this, according to your faith, be it unto you. Those are challenging words to me. If Jesus said that to me today, Murray, according to your faith, be it unto you, how much difference would there be in my life? Would there be any? Or would I have the faith of the blind man to say, yes, I believe you can do it? We are called to be people of faith. And Jesus said to the blind people, according to your faith, be it unto you. And they were healed. Unwavering obedience. Therefore, when Christ came into the world, he said, "Sacrifice and offerings you did not desire, but a body you prepared for me. With burnt offerings and sin offerings you were not pleased. Then I said, 'Here I am. It is written about me in the scroll. I have come to do your will, my God.'" Those were prophetic words quoted in Hebrews from the Old Testament. Messianic prophecy about Jesus. "A body you have prepared for me." And Jesus was willing to allow that body to be used however his Father in heaven wanted that body to be used, even if it meant a cross. Well, guess what? God has prepared a body for you too. But that body is not meant for you to spend it on your own pleasures and your own enjoyment. That body has been given to you so that you can use it to God's glory, that you can use it in kingdom work, that you can offer it back to God in any way that he chooses to use it. No matter how bizarre, no matter how sacrificial, God calls us to use our bodies in his service. "I beseech you, therefore, brethren, by the mercies of God, that you present your bodies as living sacrifices, holy and acceptable to God." Present your bodies as living sacrifices. What's a sacrifice? It's something that is given over to God, usually killed. But we are living sacrifices, giving our bodies over to God to use how he wishes. And God will transform our efforts to his glory. Acts 4:13, when the Pharisees saw the courage of Peter and John and realized that they were unschooled, ordinary men, they were astonished. And they took note that these men had been with Jesus. Isn't that beautiful? Do people know that you have been with Jesus? Do people say, "You know what, there's something different about Murray. I've heard him talk about going to church on Sundays. I wonder if there's something in that." Absolute faith. Unwavering commitment, God's ability. The first two are for us, and the Lord will supply the rest.